Thank you for coming to Colloquium and staying around during summer. You know, a lot of people are away. So it's my pleasure to welcome Leonardo Senatore, who is visiting us from Stanford and Slack. Leonardo is an assistant professor, and he is a cosmologist. He is here as part of this workshop, a very interesting and engaging workshop that we've been having on cosmic flows and other novelties on larger scales, which explores new directions in cosmology. Today, Leonardo, so let me actually first start by introducing Leonardo. So Leonardo did his PhD at MIT in 2006. He then spent postdocs at Harvard and Institute for Advanced Studies, and then started as a professor at Stanford in 2011, right? 2011? 2010. So Leonardo is a cosmologist, as I mentioned. He works in the interface of high-energy physics and cosmology, but he's been moving, it seems, more and more towards cosmology, which is a good direction, as we all know, to move into. He's done a lot of work, very, very interesting and influential work, on applying techniques from high-energy physics and effective field theory to inflation and other nonlinear properties that you may infer from cosmological observations and how they could constrain initial conditions and properties of inflation. More recently, though, he's been interested in applying the same techniques to cosmological larger scale structure, which are more immediately related to observables and to numerical simulations at the same time. So, and he's going to tell us about all the exciting things that are happening in this interface over the next hour. So here you go.
Okay, thanks very much for the invitation to give this colloquium, but also thanks for the very nice conference that you have been organizing. So we'll talk about this recent approach to Lachaise structure, which is the Fetti field theory of cosmological Lachaise structure. But let me do a bit of preface by noticing that cosmology has been a data-driven subject in the last 2 decades or so, where data have been improving relevantly in the last couple of decades. And still, there were many, many more experiments around in the space, in the South Pole, in dry areas of the Earth. So we have many, many data. And the question is that what we can do with all this data? And what in cosmology we like to do is we'd like to address universal questions, like how did the universe begin? And since the universe started with very high energies, we are naturally led to use high energy physics, both because we're learning about high energy physics when we do the Big Bang, when we study the Big Bang, but also since the universe started in an high energy state, we need to apply high energy physics techniques to study it. Now, cosmology, now it's in a very peculiar situation because the quality of the data and the amount of data is such that we have become sensitive to the nonlinearities of the dynamics, the interactions. And this is, and the study at this point, the study in the system, it becomes more complicated. But this is where applications of effective field theory are very useful. Because effective field theory is the paradigm which allows us to classify in a systematic and controllable way all possible forms of interaction that can occur in a system. And we use effective field theory both to explore energy physics. This is similar to what we do in particle physics when we study beyond the standard model physics, but also to gain control of current and next generation experiment. And this is similar to what we do when we study astrophysics and QCD, where the system is, we know what is the ultimate description, but the system is complex and we need some guidance to describe it. There are two typical examples in cosmology where this has been applied. One is the Fetti field theory of inflation that I will mention briefly, and the other is the Fetti field theory of Lachaise structure, which will be the subject of this talk. In fact, when we think about the Big Bang, we think about the initial moments, and the leading candidate for this is inflation. But let's look for a second, how do we probe inflation? The normal picture of inflation is that inflation is driven by, in the Big Bang of the universe, by a scalar field sitting on top of a flat potential. And while the inflaton is on top of the potential, the universe expands exponentially, and the inflaton slowly goes down. And then when it reaches the steep part of the potential, inflation ends. This is the standard story of inflation. But if you ask what are we actually probing of this story, Of all the words that I told you, which are the words associated to the homogeneous part of the cosmology driven by inflation, the only observable they were testing is the fact that curvature of the universe will be very small. And in fact, we have a bound about 10 to the minus 3, which we are not, this means that we are not observing curvature. All the rest of the predictions of inflation that we think we tested so far comes from the fluctuations. This is the beautiful plot by Planck. And we know, because of the peaks, that they are primordial. We know that they're scale invariant, with a slight deviation from scale invariant of order few percent. The skewness is very small, so they're quite Gaussian, about 10 to the minus 3. But at the quantitative level, to fit this beautiful picture of Planck, one is just two numbers out of inflation, the amplitude of the power spectrum and the tilt. And is this enough to conclude that what happened at the beginning of the universe was Lorentz inflation? Indeed, there are many other very different models that fit completely well the data. And in general, we don't know much of the inflaton, given that everything is just described by two numbers. For example, a much more interesting signal would be to see the frequent function of the temperature fluctuations, which, because of symmetry reason, it's really a rich function. It's a full function of two variables that depends on the shape of the triangle that the Fourier modes make in Fourier space. And you can see that one could see these kind of signals in the sky where the information is really contained in it's a two-dimensional function, so it's a three-dimensional plot. And you can see how rich there is peaks in some location, minima, way to get to the minima. This is very rich of information. It turns out that the frequent functions in the data are associated to self-interaction of the inflaton, which means that if we see non-Gaussian entities, we learn about the self-interaction of the inflationary epoch, which is really what is interesting about the physics. The physics is very simple and kind of trivial at free level, and becomes much more interesting when we're dealing with interactions. Now, we didn't see yet so far, and in fact, one can map all our knowledge of inflation directly into constraints of an effective Lagrange. This is so called effective field theory of inflation, and any information about inflation can be condensed into constraints of the parameter of this Lagrange. This is a plot we did with Kendry Smith here, where we basically show what is the allowed parameters of this effective theory Lagrange allowed by the current data. And this is, I think, it's a way to condense in a plot basically practically all what we know about inflation. In fact, this, I think, is a very important plot because it allows us to map directly cosmological information directly into particle physics information and therefore into fundamental physics information. This makes really particle physics at the level of a particle physics, cosmology at the level of a particle physics accelerator. In fact, this kind of plots and Lagrange have been used for many years in particle physics, developing the so-called precision electrowit test. One of the greatest results of the CERN, the former accelerator of CERN called LEP, was indeed produced this kind of plot. And now we can do the same for inflation. I think this is a qualitative superior way of using the cosmological data that was achieved by using indeed effective field theory techniques. Now, Planck was a very important experiment and is almost finished by now. And what has happened to theory due to Planck? Planck improves the limit with respect to what we knew already knew about the Hubble map by a factor of 3. Since non-Gaussianity scales like the ratio of the Hubble square over some high energy scale, absence of a detection of non-Gaussianity means that this high energy scale that teaches about the fundamental physics at the core of inflation is higher than what we knew by Planck, by the Hubble map, by a mere square root of 3. Now, square root of 3, this scale lambda, we don't know what it is. We're trying to understand what it is by exploring the data. And changing the lower bound on this scale by square root of 3 is not much. And this is, so Planck was a great experiment, an opportunity to change the theory if a detection happened. But given that in absence of detection, just changing the scale by square root of 3 is not changing the theory without a detection. For example, and to be fair, Planck, something else Planck did, he crossed the theoretical threshold, which was the theoretical threshold of the tilt. Inflation predicted the tilt to be of order about 10 to the minus 2. And in fact, Planck very well covered this range. And in fact, there was a mild evidence in Hubble map at order 2.5 sigma, and now we go to 6 sigma for the tilt. But this is the only theoretical threshold that was crossed by Planck very successfully, but it didn't cross any other theoretical threshold. even more important threshold. In fact, this is very different from, what, for example, what happens with the LHC experiment, which no matter what happened in experiment, the simple fact that we turned on an accelerator at 1 TeV energy changes the, our understanding of theoretical of particle physics of the standard model completely. This is not quite the case for inflation, for Planck, because little changes in the theory after Planck. Now, after Planck, cosmology is really changed. And we're facing a new epoch in cosmology, because in the last 3 decades, tremendous progress has been made through the observation of the primordial fluctuations. This is so because in cosmology, we're probably in the primordial fluctuation, which are statistical fluctuations. And the only way to understand the distribution of this fluctuation is to have many, many modes. So to probe many, many times the statistical distribution. So there are bars on everything, scales like one over the square root of the number of modes. Planck has just basically observed all the modes of the CMB. Maybe there is something else, but not much. So, and now what? Unless we are lucky, for example, we can have hope for a B-mode detection, which is not guaranteed anyway. So the only way to get sure that the progress will happen is to get more modes. Because if you don't get more modes, the cosmology as we know of is kind of over. Now, in the medium term, the only place where we can hunt for more modes is a large structure. But large structures, which are the distribution of galaxies in the universe, but we're compelled to understand them. And then do not think so far we understand them well enough. At least we don't understand them well enough to make progress beyond what already Planck has taught us. At least about the beginning of the universe. In fact, large structure surveys have been going on for several years, and the last years have been making rapid progress. In fact, something that has been measured, probably the major achievement of the last decade in the field of large structure observations is the measurement of the so-called baryon acoustic oscillations, which is just the time translation forward of the CMB fluctuation that we saw when the universe was 300,000 years old, all the way to now when we are 13 years old. These oscillations are now very well measured. These are called baryon acoustic oscillation, BAO. They carry a lot of information about the low redshift universe, because the low redshift universe was not very much seen by the cosmic microwave background. And so there was still a lot of information to be gained by exploring the high low redshift universe. But this plot does not give us much information about the early universe, the primordial universe, the Big Bang. To get much more information on the Big Bang, we need to understand more modes. And the only way to do it is to understand the next big experiments in the field, which are Large Structure Survey, LSST, Euclid, or CHIME. The number of modes in this field, in this survey, scales like the minimum number of the surveys cube, and the minimum number is just the size of the survey. But also in the numerator, there is the maximum number, the cube, which is related to how much we understand the short distance physics all the way to the until we have control. Notice that gaining control of this experiment is not trivial, because at short distances gravitational collapse happen, physics is complicated, and sometimes at some point we lose theoretical control. This is very similar to what happened in particle physics a decade ago when they moved from leptonic collider to hadronic collider. The physics became much more dirty, but also much more powerful. And I think we're in a similar situation now in cosmology. So the Fatty theory of large structure that we'll present here is really an attempt to, successful attempt, I would say, that to describe analytically the clustering of large structure in a perturbative expansion, starting from the fact that at long distances, the overdensity of the universe are very small. The universe on large distances is quite homogeneous, and as we go to shorter and shorter distances, becomes more and more inhomogeneous, until on short distances, we have order one inhomogeneities, galaxies, empty space. But it's very tempting to say that at long distances, there is a very small delta rho over rho over densities, and to try to find the theory that formulate perturbative expand around that. Let me give you some idea of how the Fatty theory is born. It's actually a very simple idea. In fact, it's very similar to what happens to dielectric materials. If you think about dielectric materials, these are very complicated on the atomic scale. But if you're interested in propagations of photons on length scales much longer than the interatomic distances, We can describe the atoms with a gross characteristic, like, for example, the dipole is some average response times the electric field at a given location. And after we crank up the machinery that you find in the books of electrodynamics, after this, if you want to study the propagation of waves in the electric material, we study Maxwell's dielectric equations. We do not study vacuum Maxwell equation with 10 to the 24 atoms. And the system is much simpler. Now, in the modern language, the theory of dielectric materials is the effective field theory of composite objects called atoms that interact with a long-range force called electromagnetism. Now, in the universe, we have just another long-range force, which is gravity. And we have objects which are charged under gravity and are composite, compact, which are called galaxies. So if you replace E&M with GR, and if you replace atoms with galaxies, you get basically the universe. So this is basically the idea of the effective theory. But let me just rephrase it in a different way. Some of you might remember, might be familiar with the Carrier-Lagrange, which describe pion interactions at energy scale between the mass of the pion all the way to 1 GeV, which is called, which is a bit about the QCD scale. Now, this Lagrange, which was developed in the 60s, described the physics of pions in a perturbed expansion in energy over this F pi, which is the QCD scale. So the system is very, very weakly coupled at low energies, and then becomes more and more, as you go to high energy, more and more strongly coupled, until it reaches the 1 GeV scale where the physics is strongly coupled. This is the QCD scale. Now, this system is very similar to, the universe is very similar to the Carrier-Lagrange, because on long distances, the perturbations are very small, but at short distances, they're very large. So you can see that the universe is quasi linear at very, very long distances, and then as we go up in distances, in wave number, at some point we hit a nonlinear scale, about 10 megaparsecs, where galaxies form, and the system becomes classically strongly coupled. So the only difference between the QCD Carrier-Lagrange and this is basically that the universe is classically strongly coupled, while QCD is quantum mechanically strongly coupled. But that's just an accessorial difference. So this effective theory seems to be working very well. I will show some results. But the bottom line is that if this holds, then the analytic control that we can have on the system of large structure is much larger than what we thought it was before. If this was what we thought we could do before, now we can do something like this. This is very rough, but this is telling you that the gain, since the number of modes goes like the maximum number cube, the gain that we can get is much larger if we have a better understanding of the theory. So if this holds, and we are a few people is working on this and is still in a preliminary stage, we don't know exactly how well it works, but if it holds as it seems to hold, this is really a revolution of what we can do, we think we can do in the next 10 years. Useful or not, I think it's also nice to have a correct description of the universe on long distances. In fact, and the universe, I think, a long distance is the effective theory of large structure. Very much like when we think about water waves, we do not think of water waves as a set of molecules, H2O molecules scattering each other and collapsing. We think of Navier-Stokes equation. And this is the simple description that is relevant at the distances that we care for ocean waves, for example. And similar is the universe. The universe is a set of dark matter particles, but we are interested only on the very long wavelength fluctuations. And the normal approach instead that we've been doing so far, the one that dominates the field, is to simulate each of the dark matter particles, which is a bit is very analogous to simulate ocean waves by simulating each H2 molecule evolution. Now, I do want to understand. I think this approach has been very successful, but I don't think it's enough. Because it doesn't give a simple description of the system. The system at long distance is much simpler. It's true that in principle this dark matter simulation works, but they're very slow, and so they're very hard to debug. And the accuracy of the result is hard to explore. For example, people acknowledge that they have systematic error of more than 1%, and the robustness of the experiment will be below 1%. Also, we cannot simulate baryons. We can only model them, and so even in principle, so there is always a question mark about that. And in fact, as a proof of this, the biggest experiment in the field, which is Sloan Digital Sky Survey, the one that discovered the baryon acoustic oscillation, stops analyzing the data at very low numbers compared to what we think we can do, even though simulations have been available for many years. I don't want to misunderstand. Numerical simulation in the past have provided some of the most beautiful history-making discoveries that came in cosmology. In fact, until the advent of the CMB, larger structures were by far the dominating way for us to explore the early universe. For example, it was discovered that dark matter is cold. The neutrino, the standard model neutrino, could not be the dark matter. The structure formed from small to ball, from small to big, and many, many others. These are fantastic discoveries that make you happy for the rest of your life. But I think after we live in a difficult time, and after the giants that made these discoveries, life became hard. And to make further progress in the field, I think we need high precision. And embodied simulations, the standard approach, at least to me, does not seem that is the only available tool. OK, let me just construct now the Fatty Field Theory. Now, we aim at describing the universe of very long distances in a perturbative way. Now, the system on very short distances is made of point-like particles. So each particle labeled by Q1, coordinate Q1, Q2, Qn, stays at some position z and evolves under Newton force. They cluster because of Newton gravity. And there is an overdensity given by how many particles position x ended up at position x. And when they cluster, they source gravity from Newton equation. These are the questions that we like to solve, but we want to solve them analytically. And we know that at short distances, the physics is very nonlinear, and there is no hope to solve them analytically. This means that this equation is not the correct equation to solve. Because there is a minimum distance for our system, which is given by the size of the nonlinear scale. We're not probing inside this linear scale with any analytic technique. Which means that it's not fair to assume that these particles are point-like, but we should assume that they are the typical size of the nonlinear scale that we're not probing. And if you take particles which have a certain intrinsic side, they don't move like point-like particles. Their center of mass moves under the force of gravity on the center of mass, but since they have an extension, they have a quadrupole, and they're sensitive to the tidal tensor of gravity, and so forth. Also, when the particle cluster, they cluster, so there is an over number density, but each particle carries some quadrupole, and also how much quadrupole is at a given location matters for gravity, and the quadrupole at a given location is the sum of the quadrupole at every location. Like we did for the electric material, the polarization at one location is the sum of the polarizability of all the atoms. So the way this extended particle source gravity is not just by the number density, but also how much energy is stored in this deformation of the quadrupoles. Very much like the electrostatic energy was charge times the potential energy, but also the dipole times the electric field. So it's very analogous. Now these equations are just derived, can be guessed, but they also can be derived from the full set of single point-like particle equation if you smoothen and focus on long distances. An equivalent way to describe this theory is to realize that the dynamics must be described by a sort of effective fluid. This is so because in the history of the universe, dark matter moves from the Big Bang to now only about 10 megaparsec. So it's quite intuitive that it can be described by an effective fluid system with a mean free path of order 10 megaparsec, this nonlinear scale. And since it interacts with gravity, matter and momentum are not conserved. So after some subtleties, which are a bit subtle, one is led to the following system of equation, where there is a Newton equation, matter conservation, and there is a momentum equation, where, however, on the right-hand side, there is a stress tensor. This stress tensor is present because short-distance physics is just given by the short-distance fluctuation, and is the way short-distance fluctuation affect long-distance physics. In fact, this tau j as a form which is very intuitive, it's the sum of the kinetic energy of the short modes and the potential energy, gravitational potential energy of the short modes. So we can see from this expression that short distance physics affects long distance physics, and therefore it cannot be ignored, even though we do not understand what short distance, we cannot describe analytically what short distance physics does. Now, this is not quite an effective theory yet, because the whole idea of the construction is to not need to describe the short distance dynamics in any detail. So how do we do that? In fact, this is not an effective theory. Now, if you're interested in distances much longer than the nonlinear scale, this tau j that affects long-distance physics is, on every given realization, more or less what is on average, because each region where there is each 10 megaparsec region, each nonlinear scale region, more or less acts independently. And if you're interested in a wavelength much longer than the nonlinear scale, more or less there is an averaging going on. So one can say that to a good approximation, tau j is every time more or less what it is when we take the expectation value on the given long, on a given configuration of long modes. Now, since long modes are small, whatever this function is can be tailor expanded in the size of the fluctuation of the long modes, because the fluctuation of the long modes are small. And then one can write all the terms that are allowed by the symmetries, which are just general relativity. And after you do this, this equation, which before contained the shell modes, now are just a function of the long modes. And so they contain only long modes, which are the ones where we claim we can solve. And therefore represent an effective field theory where the short distance physics has been integrated out. This is when you're studying in field theory, integrating out modes, this is what it is. Now you can see that in principle there is an infinite series of terms. But since all these terms are proportional to the size of the fluctuation, which are small, they go like more or less like when number over the nonlinear scale. Each term is smaller and smaller and smaller, so one keeps as many terms as required by the symmetry, by the precision of the calculation one wants to do. So for a given precision, only a finite number of terms are needed. And this makes the expansion manifestly correct in the limit of when number is much smaller than the nonlinear scale. Now, this effective theory is a bit subtle, and let me just give you a couple of subtlety. The effective theory is non-local in time. Now, when you study in normal effective field theories, you find that the effective theory, when you integrate out of some heavy particle, is local in space and time. In order for this to be the case, there must be an hierarchy of scales between the modes that we're integrating out and the modes we're interested in. Now, we're interested on long distances, and when we integrate out the galaxy is much smaller than the universe, and therefore we obtain a local in space effective field theory. But in time, we are not okay. If you consider how much two galaxies take to go around the cluster, it is an Hubble time, which is the same time scale of which the long modes evolve. So there is no hierarchy in time between the short modes and the long modes. And therefore, the effective theory is not local in time, which means that when I should go back to the former equation, and when I take the expectation value of tau j, this is a function of the long modes, but evaluated on all the past history. So there is some kernel, which I don't know what it is, and the field is evaluated on all the past history up to time t, which is the time of interest. This makes this effective theory quite unusual. Now let me forget for the moment about this subtlety. Let's imagine that it is local in time, and let me show you how perturbation theory is done. Okay, since we perturbation theory, let me just briefly mention a non-renormalization theorem. This renormalization theory is interested a bit for a different context. You might remember that some years ago, there was some people raised the question that since the universe on short distance is very nonlinear, is it possible that the nonlinearities at short distances can mimic a cosmological constant on large distances such that this acceleration of the universe even with zero cosmological constant? Now, we can answer this question because in terms of the short distance perturbation, the stress tensor takes the following form. The energy of the short modes, the way the short modes look at long distances, have an energy which is the sum of their mass, their kinetic energy, and the gravitational potential energy. Very intuitive, a galaxy looks like a point particle with the mass given by the sum of the energy. The pressure is the combination of two times the kinetic energy plus the gravitational potential energy. And if you remember, this combination, two times the kinetic energy plus the potential energy, is the combination that vanishes when objects viralized. This is very important because it tells that as soon as modes cluster and become nonlinear, so that this term becomes large, delta rho over rho becomes large, as soon as they become linear, quickly become also viralized, and as soon as they viralize, they decouple, they don't contribute to the pressure of the universe. This is very interesting. It's called this is a non-renormalization theorem because the fact that short distance mode affect long distance only through the coefficients of the stress tensor is what is called the decoupling. The fact that I can encapsulate short distance physics through a few terms in the, in the equation of motion is what is called decoupling. But usually these terms depend on all the physics at high energies. Instead, the fact that modes shorter than a linear scale, the visualization scale, do not matter, means that modes shorter than a linear scale cancel completely from affecting this parameter. And this is a normalization theorem similar to what happens in supersymmetry, where the loops shut off above the supersymmetric scale. Now, how do we do perturbation theory with this effective field theory? As I said, we need to solve this set of equations, which are just functions of the long mode, and we keep as many terms as we want to achieve the precision that we want. Now, the equations are nonlinear. For example, the momentum equation is nonlinear, the continuity equation is nonlinear. So we are going to solve in delta rho over rho, which is small because it's all the long fluctuations are small. So the nth order solution will be some Green's function acting upon some source evaluated, nonlinear source evaluated on the lower order solutions. So the second order solution will be some convolution of the linear solution with all the weight number allowed by momentum conservation. When we square them to take the expectation value, there is, by momentum conservation, we have four of these guys, and therefore there is a contribution for arbitrary short modes, because the square of two short modes can give a long mode. K short and K short plus K long, if you multiply them, can give a long mode. This can be represented in this Feynman diagram way, where two short modes contribute to a long mode. And this loop, this integral, is just the fact that there is a loop here. In fact, Feynman diagrams have nothing to do with quantum field theory, have all to do with solving perturbative field theory. And these are true Feynman diagrams as the other ones, which were originally developed. Now, for the people who is more fond of these things, let me just explain how we deal with the non-locality in time. This is because, this is important because this effective theory is quite unusual, and I think this is the only effective field theory that we know of where there is prediction, which is predictive even though it's not local in time. As I said, this tau j, which contains the formation of it tells you how short distance physics affects long distance physics, should be an integral over all former times of the long distance modes. Now, the perturbative solution has a particular structure. So it is not that we're a bit lucky. The perturbative solution has a structure with the couples. That is, delta rho in perturbation theory is the product of a function of time times delta rho linear at the final time. And this is an earlier time, for example. Then there is another function of time times the second order solution at the final time. So if I plug, since the counter terms, this tau j is going to be evaluated in perturbation theory, if I plug this term here, I get this expression, and you can see that all these terms here come out of the integral because they're all evaluated at the final time, and this, the only t prime that enters is here, is factorized with respect to the x dependence. And so one can at least formally do the integrals, and is left with some function of times times delta rho linear, times another function of times times delta rho quadratic, delta rho is second order, where each coefficient is just the moments of this kernel here. So, if the theory were to be local in time quantum field theory, for each coefficient there will be a full series of operators, which are all the ones evaluated with the solution at a given order in perturbation theory. But the counter term would be the same number for every order in perturbation theory. Instead, the non-locality in time, coupled with the fact that the perturbative solution decouples in this way, is such that the non-locality in time is reflected that there is a given coefficient for each order in perturbation theory. So this leads to a multiplication, more terms, more counter terms than what are normally present in a local quantum field theory, but it's just numbers, it's not a functions, and so it's just a few more numbers, so it is under control. So it's not a disaster. Which is, for example, if one builds an effective theory by integrating out a photon, obtains a disaster, I think. Now, going back to our perturbative solution, we said that the loops takes the following form. and we're integrating over arbitrarily short moons. Now, let's imagine that the universe was some power law universe like this, simple power law. These are called non-scale universes. Then if I do this integral, I find that the leading term is actually divergent, and I need to take a cutoff lambda. Now, the fact that I get infinite, maybe if I cut off, I get something finite, but cutoff dependence, tells me that I did the calculation wrong, because the nature doesn't care of the cutoff, so the result cannot be cutoff dependent. The reason why there is a mistake here is because we extrapolated this equation of motions where they were not valid any longer, all the way to short distance physics. But the point, as we discussed, is that short distance physics cannot be described in perturbation theory. We don't want to describe it because we cannot make it. But short distance physics affected long distance through this stress tensor, which the leading term was this C squared delta rho. If I insert this stress tensor in perturbation theory, I get the following contribution. And this stress tensor encapsulates how short distance physics affects long distance physics. And so it should be able to correct any mistake I do from extrapolating the equation of motion all the way to where they don't apply any longer, and to give a corrective to give the right result. In fact, you can see that this term has exactly the same functional form as this term. And so once I add the two results, I get that the P on one loop, the power spectrum in one loop, plus the linear power, the CS power spectrum, gives the CS term finite, what is left after subtracting this infinite contribution, plus times the linear power spectrum times K over K non-linear square, plus time which is smaller, and also smaller and smaller in K over K non-linear. So what is done here is nothing, we just did in one slide what is called renormalization. Renormalization has nothing to do with quantum field theory, with quantum, it just to do with field. And you can see that after renormalizing, the result of the one loop plus the counter term is smaller than the linear power spectrum. So the loop is a small correction to the linear power spectrum and smaller contributions. Therefore, let me comment a bit on this because it's a very important result. After renormalization, the contribution of each loop is smaller and smaller because it goes like K over K non-linear to DL as the K is smaller and smaller, the loop is smaller and smaller. This is the crucial difference with former approaches which didn't put any counter term. Notice, in fact, that if you don't put a counter term, each loop will go like lambda, some cutoff over K non-linear to DL, and so each loop is larger and larger and larger, and the result doesn't converge at all. It actually gets worse and worse and worse. Also, for the people who are aficionados, this term here was degenerate with the counter term, and so we say that it's not calculable in effective field theory. But the next term in the K over K non-linear expansion was this KQ POK. Now, since this term is not analytic, it's not degenerate with the counter term. There is no counter term from the stress tensor that goes like a cube, POK. And so this term, whatever is the result of the calculation, cannot be changed. These are the calls which are so-called, these are the terms which are infrared calculable in effective theory. And in relativistic quantum field theory, these terms are impossible. And the only terms that we get are called are logarithmics. And this is why the beta functions, which are the prefactor of the logarithms, can be computed. For example, we can compute it for the standard model, for the MSSM, independently of what is quantum gravity or what is the ultraviolet structure. Because they become ultraviolet physics cannot change this coefficient. This theory is non relativistic, and so the structure of the nonlinear term is richer, and so it's somewhat more interesting. Now, in the universe, the story is slightly more complicated than what I showed, because there are many scales in the problem. In fact, as I told you, we solved this equation expanding in the smallness of the long wavelength fluctuations. And if you expect the terms that you're expanding on, you realize that there are two kinds of expansion one is doing. One is the effect of, on a given mod k, the effect of the force, delta rho over rho, on a given k, and this contributes only up to the number k of interest. So it's contribution from modes longer than the mode of interest. And this is the gravitational force. But there is also a contribution, again, from the modes longer than the mode of interest, which is scales like P of Q over Q squared, so it's by units must be multiplied by K squared. This is units of displacements, and it's the fact that the long mode tend to displace a given short range regions, and secretly, when we solve this equation, we are expanding also in these short modes. In this amount of displacements. Needless to say, this contribution is much more infrared receive much more contribution from the infrared mode than this, because simply there is a Q squared downstairs. Now, if the universe is not scaled, there is no scale, and so all these contributions scale the same like K over K nonlinear to some power. But our universe has features, for example, it's the baryon acoustic oscillation feature, and so these different contributions grow with a number K in a different way. In particular, for the modes of interest, the effect of long displacement is already over the one. And so it cannot be treated in perturbation theory, because if I spend a parameter which is one, we don't converge. But since the long displacements are long, are infrared dominated, and so we know exactly what they are. Perturbation theory can describe them very well. And since their displacement displace, they're not forced, they do not deform the object, they simply move it around, it's pretty easy to compute their effect without any expansion, and fully nonlinearly. And this can be done, and we did it in this paper. So after you do this, the effect theory only expands in the effect of forces, which is this epsilon delta. And after normalization, each loop counts like epsilon delta to the L. So each loop is smaller and smaller and smaller. But two steps are necessary, IR infrared summation and renormalization. So this tells you that this theory is very similar to what happens in quantum field theory. For example, in quantum electrodynamics, one has to resum infrared divergences coming from soft photon and to have a well-defined perturbative expansion, and here it's the same. Let me quickly go through some of the results. So this is basically the structure of the theory, and let me just show you some results. Now, as I mentioned, perturbative loops receive contribution from very short modes, which are not under control, so whatever is the result is wrong. And so, one needs to add counter terms, this stress tensor term, which have the role of correcting the mistake done by the loops. At one loop order, one can see that only one counter term is needed to make the result independent of what happens in the loop at high wave number, where we don't know what we are doing. Now, when we go to two loops, the theory becomes more and more UV divergent, and more counter terms are needed. For example, at two loops, one can explore these two counter terms, sort of quadratic speed of sound and an higher derivative speed of sound. The fact that these terms are needed can be checked by computing the two loop contribution with a cutoff equal infinity. These loops turn out to be convergent, so we can do with a cutoff equal infinity, or with a cutoff equal to H inverse megaparsec, which we all dreamed that this would be inside the linear regime. Nobody thinks that 2H inverse megaparsec redshift 0 is inside the linear regime. You can see that if you do the ratio of these two, you get this dashed line, which is clearly not 1. So this means that the loop is ultraviolet sensitive, and so it's sensitive to something we don't control. By adding this counter term, instead one can see that the result of the two loop with different cutoffs agree, and so these two counter terms are necessary in the calculation to make the calculation ultraviolet insensitive. And from this estimate, one can even get a sense of what is the typical size that is expected. But the fact that this works, the fact that the UV dependence can be canceled by this counter term is another proof of the correctness of this effective field theory. Because if it was incorrect, it wouldn't be able to correct for the ultraviolet dependence. So at two loop, we need a there are three counter terms that are needed. The speed of sound was already needed in one loop plus these two. The way how do we choose them? One option is to feed them directly to the data. And instead of taking the observational data, I take the numerical data. The way to measure them is that we can ask the theory to agree with the data as a function of the maximum wave number of the theory in which we fit. And as we added more and more modes, you should see this brown band, the determination of the parameter gets better and better. In order to avoid the risk of overfitting, because since the power spectrum is limited on the amount of information, one can simply impose that the measurement given when number is compatible with the result that we got a lower number, even though the robots were larger, in order to assure that imposing the fit to work at high wave number does not harm the fit at lower number. For example, from these plots, we conclude that this compatibility with the measurement at lower number begins to fail around 0.334, and that's where we stop matching the data. So after this procedure, with free counter terms, you find that the effective theory matches the data all the way to about 0.34 H inverse megaparsec. So here I present a plot of the linear power spectrum, one loop power spectrum and two loop power spectrum. You see that at each order in perturbation theory, things improve, as they should, because each loop is smaller and smaller. They go like over canonical to the number of loops. You can see all former techniques failed. Notice that the error bars here are very small, about 10 to the minus 3 here. Notice that all former theory fail at about 0.03 H inverse megaparsec. So at this level of accuracy, the linear scale is not 0.1, it's 0.03 H inverse megaparsec. So you see that there is a huge gain with respect to former theory. Also, since this is a perturbative technique, one can estimate the effect of higher order term by plotting a theory error. And this gray band represents the estimated theory error. So the theory here fails at 0.34, but you can see it could fail also at 0.26. Now, I would like to stress that all former theories, RPT, LPT, the one you choose, differ from the standard perturbation theory, which is the one I normally plot, just by the contribution of the IR summation. By general relativity, IR modes, however, cancel in the power spectrum apart from the baryon acoustic oscillations. So any IR summation cannot change the broadband K reach of the theory apart from fixing the baryon acoustic oscillation. You can see here that there is no residual between the theory and the nonlinear scale and the power spectrum measured from simulation, which is the nonlinear scale. The nonlinear power spectrum, because the Bayesian features are correctly reproduced. So the IR summation, this theory is correct, but any IR summation cannot change how much the theory matches the data in the UV apart from fitting the baryon acoustic oscillation correctly. So RPT and anything else should be equal to SPT when implemented correctly, apart from getting the BO right. So, and if you have doubts about this, please ask me offline. I'm very happy to give explanation. The fact that former theory fails at 0.03, you can see here, this is a standard perturbation theory, but as I said, all theories should behave like, former theory behave like this. This was linear theory, this is the power spectrum of the non-Wiggle power spectrum. It's different from here where I divide by the result, which is the nonlinear power spectrum. The data here, you can see linear theory, one loop, two loop. The theory does not converge, and actually you can see that one loop fails here, two loop fails earlier, with 1% precision, so two loop is worse than one loop. It's not only doesn't converge, it goes in the opposite direction, as it should, because there are divergences. And you can see that it fails about 0.03. But independently of what the K-reach is, it's very important to have a system which converges and achieves arbitrary precision at a given certain Wien numbers. If instead of focusing on how much is the K-reach is, one focuses on how much is the Wien number, you can see that this is linear theory, this is in one loop, and this is the black is two loop. You can see that there is a remarkable, for a given fixed Wien number, converges to more and more precision. In fact, the precision is so high now, where precision better than 10 to the minus 3, which is for sure beyond what people in body simulation is safe to guarantee this correction as being accurate. And notice that these are chime-like error bars. Okay, so better be able to predict the theory at this level. Now, chime is my favorite. I like it. Now, this is the first way to measure the parameter. Just look at the long wavelength power spectrum and impose the theory to match the data, to measure the parameter. This is how we do when we measure the electric charge from electron-electron scattering. But these parameters are needed, but there is another way in which we can measure them. We can measure them directly from small embodied simulations. This speed of sound, for example, which is one of the counterterms, is an emergent speed of sound. The dark matter does not have speed of sounds intrinsically, but if you look at the dark matter long distances, we have a speed of sound. So one can try to extract this emergent speed of sound by looking directly at the stress tensor of the dark matter particle. So one can take a small, very small embodied simulation, like 20 megaparsec, and compute evaluate the dark matter power spectrum, which is the sum of the kinetic energy of the dark matter particle and the potential energy of the dark matter particle, and ask how much this depends on delta on the long wavelength mode, and see, and this, the derivative with respect to this dependence is the speed of sound. This procedure uses directly the dark matter particle to estimate, which are the ultraviolet degrees of freedom, to extract a parameter out of the long wavelength theory, which is a fluid, so two different objects. This is similar to what happens, for example, in QCD, when people extract the parameters from the Carrot-Lagrange, like fpi, which are parameters of the pion Lagrange, using the degree of freedom that constitute at high energy the pions, which are the quarks. So in lattice QCD, people have measured fpi, and this and so that agrees with pion-pion scattering measurement. And here we did the same. We used this definition of the stress tensor, extracted the speed of sound, and we found numbers that, after taking account of the lattice running, that is, if you take a box and define this stress tensor on a box, you must provide the defective theory, and the defective theory should do calculation with this box size, because all the modes up to the box, short modes of these modes, have been already been taken care of. As we change the box size, the loops in the theory must change, must be cut off at the same scale, because to account for the modes that are not taken account any longer as soon as we smooth the tau j in a different way. So how much the speed of sound changes as soon as we change the region over which we sum the tau j is how much the loop in perturbation theory change. So this is the change in the loop in perturbation theory, and this is the data point. You see that it works perfectly. This is well known in particle physics. This phenomenon is called lattice running. And you can see that the universe has galaxies have lattice running as well. And the number that you get is in agreement, quite in agreement with what the number we get from simulation. Notice that I did this mainly with a string theory, so it's already a miracle that we're close by a bit close. Ah. And the number that we get is very important, is the same size as the number that the speed of the chocolate syrup has. So we always knew that the universe is sweet to cosmologists, and this is a proof. Okay. Now, since this is a theory and not just a model, it's not a model for the power spectrum. This is a theory for the dynamics of whatever happens in Lattice structure. The same parameter enter in several observables. For example, one can compute the frequency function, which is the same function, the same parameter, momentum cross correlations, vorticity power spectrum, and they all agree with what the result from simulation to the level that they should. Now, another aspect that we need to do in order to understand Lattice structure is understand the baryonic physics. Baryons, as we know, the way I know them is that at some point they collapse and they begin to explode, and it's complicated things here. Stars explode, gamma ray burst, anything. And everybody agrees that these effects cannot be described by first principle in a numerical simulation. And so they create a lot of concern in the community because of this. But actually, it's very easy to correct the effect of baryons along wavelengths. In fact, if you remember, the main idea of the effective field theory for dark matter, when applied to dark matter, was that dark matter in the history of the universe moves only about 10 megaparsec. And so it's a fluid-like system with mean free fluff about 10 megaparsec. Now, if you think about baryons, at some point, they're heated by the radiation of the star formation. But this radiation just hits the baryon. They don't move them around. So the baryons still move about, in the history of the universe, about 10 megaparsec. So on distances longer than the nonlinear, and which is the same scale as dark matter. So on distances longer than this nonlinear scale, the universe with cold dark matter plus baryon is just an effective theory with two species, two fluid species, the dark matter species and the baryon species. So there is a speed of sound for baryons, like there was for dark matter, which is induced by gravitational collapse, plus there is another speed of sound, degenerate, which induces C-star because it's induced by star formation. This is important because it tells you that at long distances, the leading effect of short-distance physics is known as a specific functional form, k squared p of k, and it has a coefficient which is unknown, the speed of sound induced by star formation, which will depend on the star formation physics, IT galactic nuclei, supernova, I don't know what they are. Here is the comparison with the simulation by the group of Shoshaye, different star formation models. And you can see that they all had the functional form k squared p linear. And changing the overall prefactor, which is just a number, fits all the models of star formation physics. So baryons are not really a problem at long distances. Also, for some observation, we don't observe directly the dark matter or the baryon diffuse. We observe galaxies. And galaxies are complicated objects, which we know they are thought to be tracer of the underlying long wavelength dark matter field. So if you take a galaxy, which each pixel is very, very complicated, this, the distribution of galaxies in the universe is just a known deterministic function of the long wavelength field that source them. So similar consideration that what I've done before can be extended to bias. And the field of galaxies at a given location is just a function evaluated on all former times of all fields, long wavelength fields, configuration of the long wavelength fields allowed by general relativity. So one writes all the possible terms, but also integrated in time. So for example, I think this offers the correct parametrization of assembly bias, that is somewhat mysterious phenomenon that people observe in simulation. I think this does it. And one can see that to compute the one loop power spectrum and the three-level bispectrum and three-level trispectrum, the same parameter enter in multiple observables. And so with seven parameters, one can predict those kind of observables, which are many. We checked on simulations, and it works more or less as it should. With bigger error bar, it works more or less as expected for Dark Matter. And similar considerations are applied to redshift speed distortions, where we just work out the formulas, and we are just comparing now with simulations. So the description that I described in detail for Dark Matter, then extended to baryons and also to galaxies, and simply measured to redshift speed distortion, tell us that it's possible to formulate a manifestly convergent perturbation theory in the quasi-linear regime. But the quasi-linear regime is beyond what we thought before. It's around 0.3, and then we can discuss it. We'll try to converge a bit on the details, but it's beyond 0.03 where former theories fail. This means that large structure survey, this is, by the way, is redshift zero, I should mention it. Much better higher redshift. This means that there is much more modes than what people believed for before, and this can have huge consequences of what we can do in the next generation experiments. For example, FNL, Order 1, neutrinos, dark energies. These things that we didn't even dream about seems that now we can start thinking about. This is the beginning, and to tell you the truth, the number of people working on this field is limited, so we're not done. But this result is telling us that there is a huge opportunity beyond around the corner, and we have to see if we can grasp it. So let me summarize. I went through this novel effective filter of large structure, which is a novel and powerful way to analytically describe the large structure of the universe. So it describes something true, the universe, and there is no question that this is right, so this is, and the universe is also right, so this is something true that will remain. And so it has many applications for astrophysics. Astrophysics usually tend to describe something that is true. It uses, however, novel techniques that comes a lot from particle physics, loop divergence, Cantor term, renormalization, non-renormalization theorem, IR divergences. They all were developed somehow in a different field and find this powerful application in large structure. Measuring simulation, which in particle physics is called lattice running, even quite subtle effect in field theory are present here. As I said, it's just the beginning. And many calculations, verifications, better measurement of the parameter needs to be done. But I think this is a huge opportunity also for complementarity with simulations, because once we understand how to make the long-distance physics of the universe well, we need simulation only for the short-distance physics, and maybe simulation should begin to focus on being accurate so that we can extract with the relevant accuracy, precision and accuracy, the parameters that we need to predict the long-distance physics. So this is maybe ask for a different kind of simulation, numerical simulation to be done. But if the success continues as has been going on so far, I think this is really a revolution of our expectation for next generation experiments for doing primordial cosmology. Okay, thank you very much.
One thing that was found in Lattice QCD was that there was a terrific synergy that existed between explicit perturbative calculations and effective field theory of the kind that you're talking about, and then the explicit numerical simulations. Do you see that same kind of synergy occurring for the work that you're doing and the numerical people?
Yeah, I'm trying very hard for that. Thank you for asking this question. In fact, this allowed me to highlight that this work I did with a string theorist. This is the amount of synergy there was at the beginning. But I think it's growing. Numerical simulations have been doing things in a different way. They've been very successful. But the point is that now we have to change. I think that we have to change the requirements because Planck happened. And if we want to continue cosmology, early universe cosmology, we need to much more precision. And so things, I think, has to change. It takes time to change culture. But some good people is getting into the game, so especially young people, I should say. So there is hope.
Good. Now that you have this plot up, what's happening at the small lambda? This seems to be going up and up at some point.
No, it saturates. In fact, you should take the limit lambda goes to infinity. The lambda goes to infinity limit is the one that you should get from the long wavelength theory.
So what happens at lambda goes to zero?
I think at some point, the power spectrum has a slope. This is in the UV. Then I think that it's turned around. It will just turn around. But this plot is to be is applies on the box size. This is a very small box size, so
you shouldn't
extrapolate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Matt has a question.
So when you get this factor of 100 from the K max over K min, this is kind of just the like standard mode counting where. Like modes are uncorrelated, and so these corrections are correlating scales, right? And so maybe that estimate is a little bit. I know it's a twiddle estimate, so. So I guess I was just wondering. Do you think that estimate still works?
Yeah. Let me answer in two ways. First, this is the one I did. It's squiggly. If you want to do, I agree with you that a careful estimate. Or the Fisher metric should be done. If you want to do it, you're welcome. That is, we need people to help in this field. This is a big field now. I think if this is going to happen, it's going to become a big field, and we need many people to do these things. So I didn't do it. You're welcome to do it. However, I think people is also always worried about the correlation modes. Let me clarify at least this. The fact that the theory works until here, apart within the arrow bars of this gray band, tells you that this is the reach of the perturbative technique. This means that there is information from the initial condition about this. And this means, but doesn't mean that all the information is in the two-point function. What this plot tells you is that we expect a similar reach in the 3, 4, 5, whatever is the point for any point per function. In this theory, all the endpoint functions should fail at a given order, more or less at the same point. So deformation is spread among all these endpoint functions. And the reconstructed primordial power spectrum probably requires observing a certain number of endpoint functions. For example, this power spectrum is a two-loop, which probably means that for the information about until 0.3 or 0.25, whatever, around there, one probably needs up to the five-point function. So the system is complex. Life might be hard, but maybe it's doable. And if you look at the progress of QCD people in the last 20 years, it's remarkable how things have been done. So maybe things can happen also in this field.
So actually, on that note, I don't see Wei Li here, but I think he had a paper a few years ago suggesting that this K cubed increase of information kind of flattens out for a while and then goes
back understanding,
up.
Yeah, my understanding is that was just for the power spectrum. And my answer was just effect. This information is spread to the higher endpoint function, but it is in the perturbative regime, we can get it. If I can compute it, I can get it out.
Right,
but it might be algorithmically complex, but in principle, we can.
Okay. Good. Other questions?
One of the things which I didn't quite understand, and I should, is that your statement that in equilibrium, the pressure is zero. I mean, I'm used to the virial theorem, of course.
Ah,
but where did the phi come from in the tau ij expression?
In fact, this is a very tau ij that what people thought there was, exactly. Yeah, this is our tau ij is different than what
you were dealing with some kind of new tau ij.
Exactly. Yeah, I would call it the correct tau ij, but okay. Yes, the tau ij here is not the naive tau ij. In fact, this is you can call it a gravitational fluid. That is, in a normal tau ij, in a normal fluid, gravitational field is not part of the stress tensor. Here it is. Technically, where it comes from is that these equations are really should be written, and are really written, because we cut out delta. B is.
There's a grad long rho that appears, or
exactly.
And so that doesn't appear. So you're effectively treating that as another kind of force. I mean, it's just how you're juggling things.
Yeah. So the momentum. Strange. So you can derive this effective equation, this effective equation by taking the Darmstadt equation as smoothing, and you will find that there's an equation for the momentum. The velocity is just a change of variable. In the momentum, there are two linear terms, v grad v, which gives the v square here, but also rho grad phi, which can be manipulated to become something like this. Then when you go back to velocity, okay. So the rho grad phi is also a non-linear term.
No, I know that, and I see how you combine it, but I don't see where the grad long rho.
No, they're all there, but because by integration by parts, the grad long you can put on Laplacian of phi. We can do the algebra, but there was a rho grad low, and then what matters was another grad of this. You see, there is a grad outside. One has to use at some point the replacement that on this smoothing region, there is a Laplacian of phi becomes rho. And I can do the derivative. I don't have any.
Well, there are chalks there if you want to write something down, but we could also.
The algebra for this part is a bit long because you have to integrate a few times by parts. We can start doing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the standard approach has the problem. Has the problem that there is another nonlinear term, which is rho short times grad phi short. And this is as not under control as the V short, grad phi short that one had before. And this also requires counter term. In fact, this is the combination that cancels in the virialized limit. Otherwise, nothing cancels.
Okay, so it looks like a good time to break. Let's thank Leonardo again.